My guest at this time is Mark Mix, president of the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation. We've asked him to comment on Monday's arguments at the Supreme Court over whether union dues can be taken from the paychecks of non-members. And Mark, thanks very much for being with us.
Well, glad to be with you. This is an exciting day indeed, and it's interesting that the Supreme Court, the highest court in the land, hears the case of an employee, and this is how the system should work. At least he gets his voice heard.
The case in question centers around Illinois Department of Public Health employee Mark Janis, I think I'm saying that correctly, who has $50 taken out of his check each month, and that's sent to the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees Union. The argument from the unions is that their work impacts the non-member because of their collective bargaining efforts, so ultimately their work benefits all workers, so those dues are therefore reasonable. What's the rebuttal to that?
Well, the fact that the unions have positioned themselves as the exclusive bargaining agent and the monopoly voice of all workers in the public sector is really the issue, and this is the fundamental problem and the injustice of this particular situation. You know, the unions say that everything they do benefits everybody that they come in contact with. That's just not true. And so the idea is that Mark Janis, our client in the case we represented today at the Supreme Court, is basically saying that what they're doing in some cases hurts him, in some cases it's arguable that it doesn't help him, in some cases it probably does. But the bottom line is that he would lose his job if he did not pay these fees to the union. So he has, in order to work for his government and have a voice, he's got to pay a private organization for that privilege. We believe that it all should be voluntary. And if the unions are doing great work and they're providing all these great benefits, then workers will join them voluntarily, and that's the way it should work. And we hope the Supreme Court agrees with Mark and us that this all should be voluntary.
Take us inside the oral arguments, if you can, Mark. What did the justices want to know from your side, and what do they want to know from the labor side?
Well, it's interesting. Our attorney, Bill Messenger, was asked that question. You know, if you could say anything you didn't get a chance to say, what would you have said? And he said, I would have sat down and not said any more, because he thought like he connected with the justices on the court. They understood the issue. In fact, this is not a new issue for the Supreme Court. We've been there in 2012 in a case called Knox that touched on this compulsory power. We were there in 2014 in a case called Harris that touched on this compulsory unionism power. The justices heard a case in 2016 called Friedrichs that was exactly like this Janis case, and today they heard the Janis case. So in the last 5 years, they have asked and talked about this issue, so they were well informed. Justice Kennedy was pretty animated and interested in this case. He's, you know, the First Amendment is really the ultimate question here. Justice Thomas didn't ask a question. Justice Gorsuch did not ask a question. Roberts had a few, Alito had a couple, and Sotomayor and Kagan kind of led the charge for the other side. It was interesting. Most of the people I talked to said that it was a good debate, a healthy debate, and certainly it looked like the court understood exactly the question in front of them.
Well, you mentioned the case 2 years ago that is pretty much identical to the one that was heard at the court today. Of course, that one deadlocked at 4-4 due to the death of Justice Scalia, and the other eight justices in that case are still on the court. The only difference is Justice Gorsuch, and as you mentioned, he didn't say anything today. So what do we read either from his nonverbal cues or from his previous experience, if any, on these issues to suggest which way he might go here?
Well, Greg, congratulations on trying to ask me to predict what the Supreme Court's going to do. I won't do that, but you had to ask, and I understand that. That was great. Look, we hope that the fundamental argument of free speech is going to going to hold the day. Like I said, there's nothing in this case, if we win it, if Mark Janis wins this case, there's nothing that stops any individual from not joining a union. It won't prohibit anything. It just simply gives individual workers the choice. And really, when you boil this out, that's what this is. It's a battle literally between union officials and the rank and file workers they claim to represent. Because what they're saying is, if you give these workers a choice that are, quote, allegedly their brothers and sisters in the workplace, if you give them a choice, they may decide to do something different. And that's really the fundamental issue at the bottom of this case is union officials are worried that if workers are given the choice, they may choose not to support them financially. And that's really the really simple part of this whole question.
Dig a little deeper, though, in terms of the First Amendment side of this, I guess, more than anything else, but feel free to take it in any direction you want. What's the big picture impact? Obviously, Mark Janis and people in his position would be able to do with what they want with that money, but what's the larger impact if your side wins?
Well, I certainly think we're seeing the response now from organized labor officials across the country. They're trying to convince legislatures to give them the authority to collect money from taxpayers if they lose the Janus case. We're seeing things pop up in New York and California and Washington State and Hawaii where they're going to ask the taxpayers now to pay the fees that they can no longer collect from non-members if we win this case. I think it's a money question. It's a big money question. You know, organized labor in this country is a $20 billion a year business. And in 22 states, they have the power to force a worker to pay them a fee for the privilege of working for their government. And so it's a good business model if you can get it. It's a difficult one to hang on to because it comes with this persona of being force, and it's compulsion. And there's no question about that. If you don't pay the dues, you don't work. No matter what the dues are, you don't work. So that's really where the issue boils down to. I think the implications are pretty dramatic. It would probably tend to militate in favor of union officials getting a little better at customer service and convincing workers there's a reason for them to join voluntarily. It may change their business model. It may change their behavior. And if that's the case, that's a good thing. If they don't change their behavior, then workers will use their new rights to opt out of supporting the system that heretofore has been compulsory.
Mark, I know your organization has also been very active over the years in defending union members who don't like to see their money being used for political causes they don't agree with. If you're able to win in this case with the non-member, do you think that sets the ground for a more effective challenge on issues like that?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, Greg, and it's a good one, because if unionism is voluntary and you're a member of the union, then you have the ability to exercise your rights. And so we wouldn't contest that. I mean, if you want to be a member of the union and you want to support them financially and you want to be involved with them, that right should be protected, and it is protected. Our issue comes to bear when they use this and rely on this power of compulsion. So, you know, there's been cases that have tried to do that. But regulating union membership, per se, if you want to be a voluntary member, is not something we're necessarily interested in, but certainly giving the individual worker the choice to help to control not only their livelihoods, but control the, you know, the unions that they want to be part of by holding union officials accountable by being able to vote with their pocketbooks is something that I think is a natural result of this particular type of case and this line of reasoning. And hopefully this victory we're going to win at the U.S. Supreme Court.
And we'll find out here in the next few months what the actual verdict is. Last question on this. Mark, you mentioned the financial frustrations from organized labor and the fact that at least in some blue-leaning states, they're likely to go ask the taxpayers for that, or at least force legislation that would make the taxpayers give them that money. What's been the impact of right-to-work legislation on the financial health of organized labor?
Well, I think if you look at some of the anecdotes and some of the results in a state like Wisconsin, where Act 10 was passed back in 2011, and Scott Walker kind of stood up and said, "Hey, we're not going to eliminate bargaining." The unions say that they eliminated bargaining. They did not. They just simply said they limited the scope of bargaining in Wisconsin, and they passed a right-to-work law for public sector employees in the state. You know, the unions in some cases walked away from bargaining units. Their revenue went down. Some places, the union's still there. They're doing their job, and I suspect that they're changing their model. But I suspect that what's going to happen is they're going to have to figure out a new way to do business. And whether that comes with this notion they're going to go force the taxpayers to pay for it, I think that gets them deeper into the hole as opposed to providing solutions for them. And they may win on the short term by getting taxpayers to fund it. But I think once the taxpayers find out that they're paying a private organization taxpayer money to do the work that they're doing, I think that will be another problem for organized labor down the road.
More fights to come. We'll see what happens in this case first. Mark, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, Greg.
Mark Mix is president of the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation. I'm Greg Corumbus reporting for Radio America.